Welcome back to the 21 and Sensory podcast with me, Emily. On today's episode, I am very excited to chat to special guest, Dr. James Cusack. James is Chief Executive at Autistica, which is the UK's national autism research charity. He joined the charity in September 2015 as Director of Science following a career in autism research at the University of Aberdeen, and he later became Chief Executive there in 2020. Autistica focuses on giving autistic people the opportunity to live long, happy, and healthy lives. They do this by funding research, shaping policy, and working with autistic people to understand their needs. So I'm really excited to chat to James a bit more about Autistica, as well as more about him and his background. So James, would you like to say hello?
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Thank you for being up for chatting to me. It's going to be really interesting to talk to you. Obviously, it sounds like you do a lot and you juggle a lot as chief executive of, you know, a national autism charity. But maybe let's start kind of more with you, and then we'll kind of talk a little bit about your career in a bit. Mm-hmm. So if it's okay, I'd really be keen to talk more about any diagnoses you have. Obviously, I know you're autistic, but it'd be really interesting to hear the journey and the process that you went through.
Yeah, sure. So, my primary diagnosis is that I'm autistic. When I was really quite young, I think my mum and dad were quite aware that there was something different about me. I'm the oldest in the family, but my brother is only 15 months younger than me, so they had quite an interesting comparison, and I think they could see some real differences between him and myself. And so that meant that from quite an early age, they were quite aware, and the health system was quite aware that there was something different about me, but it took them quite a while to work out why that was. And although I did show all the sort of classic sort of signs or behaviors associated with being autistic, I didn't actually get a diagnosis at three, because I didn't have a learning disability at that time, that was sort of seen as a bit of an exclusion factor, because at that time most people who were autistic also had a learning disability. But I was diagnosed with having what they sort of saw as a motor coordination disorder or motor coordination difficulties. So I got a lot of help and physiotherapy with that. And, you know, I think went to primary school and nursery, kind of always aware there was something different about me. My parents were kind of aware there was something different about me, but no one could really put their finger on what it was. And then, you know, as I was getting ready to go to secondary school, it became increasingly evident that I was quite different. And then eventually that led to my diagnosis, I think just about the age of just when I just turned 12. That was quite an interesting experience, I think, you know, particularly from my parents, but also at that time when autism was just really not as well known at all. So that would be 1997 when I got the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting that, like, to me, like, you being diagnosed at 12, like, that sounds quite early on, but actually, mm-hmm. if you think about it, you were just starting secondary school, so you were, you know, kind of, you'd done the whole of primary school and the whole kind of, you know, your younger years and childhood without knowing. So actually, it kind of is a late diagnosis, being like 12 years old and then knowing this about yourself. Do you think it helped? Did it give you like a sense of kind of clarity, and were kind of school understanding of that?
I think a couple of things about that. I think, you know, and one, like you say, it's interesting, isn't it? It's about kind of how you frame it. And I think, like, on one hand, it was actually quite early compared to a lot of people, but on the other hand, it was what was interesting about it to me was the fact that you can sort of be in the system and people be aware of you and almost be getting assessed but not be recognized. And I think that is one step forward that we would see now. Like, I think if I was in the system now in the way that I was back then, I think I would have been recognised. But also, I look at a lot of people who aren't diagnosed with adulthood and who have a number of real challenges throughout their life, and I do feel very, very lucky to have been diagnosed at such a relatively younger age. And I think what I always think the diagnosis helps with is it helps you to understand yourself, and it helps everyone around you to understand you as well. Mm-hmm. It took a while to build that understanding, and I think the process, for everyone, even up until now, following diagnosis can be better. I think, the great thing about a diagnosis is that and one of the most helpful things about a diagnosis, and one of the ways in which a diagnosis can most immediately add value, is in that sort of helping to understand yourself. What does this mean for me? What does this mean about where my strengths are? What does this mean about where the areas are where I might have some difficulties or needing some extra support? And I think in the end that's proved to be very, very helpful. And in some ways, as we began to talk about neurodiversity, one of the things that I often say to people who are new to these fields is that, if you're autistic, you've been forced to think about who you are and who you are relative to other people. And I actually think that in some ways, there's people in the general population who don't have any diagnosis, who haven't been forced to ask themselves this question, who would really benefit from that. So I actually think it's just generally being put in a position following a diagnosis where you're forced to think about who you are and what sort of support you need, I think is really, really helpful. And also it was, of course, extremely beneficial for me, because without that diagnosis, I wouldn't have got the support that I got in school. And that sort of recognition. And then, I think that was a real sliding doors moment for me. Like, I think my outcome in life would have been very different if I didn't get, the quality of support that I got when I was at school.
Mm-hmm. It's really nice to hear from someone who actually had support, because yeah. There's so many different people that I have talked to on this podcast and just in real life who just haven't had, either the diagnosis at the time that they were, at school or university, or they knew something, they were struggling, but they just couldn't get the access because they didn't have that diagnosis. So it's really nice to hear from someone that actually did have that support and actually benefited from that.
I think it's so I was lucky. I went to, when I was, this was 1997, I went to the first ever base built within a secondary school that was especially designed for people who were autistic, and for me that worked extremely well. And I guess life is like a developmental condition for everyone in a way, and it's sort of a developmental process. And for me at that point in time, if I didn't get that support, I don't think I'd be able to to work or to go to university or to experience the world in the way that I do now. I think I would find it very, very difficult, because when I entered school, it was extremely difficult. And so I feel very lucky and privileged. And, I know we might come on to this later, but, one of the things I always say, in the CEO role is like, I can tell you about my experience, but it is a very privileged one. And, unfortunately, there are, I am the, exception rather than the rule in terms of the luck that I've had, in terms of the support that I've had. And I think one of the things that we try to talk about as a charity, Autistic Eyes, it's really pivotal that everyone gets the right support from day one, and that we have a plan for people following a diagnosis. Because, I remember when my mum came out into the car, and I remember I was sitting in this Renault Clio waiting for my mom, not really understanding why I had to keep seeing the psychologist. Mm-hmm. My mom sort of came out into the car, obviously visibly very upset and not really sure what's happened next. And I think the thing that really, is hard to accept for me is the fact that this still continues to happen. And, you know, they're still parents and autistic people and kids sort of going through this, you know, experience of day, and it's really avoidable. We can be providing people with, like, for example, things like good psychoeducation, helping them, giving them some support to understand what the diagnosis means for them. You know, that's not an expensive thing to do for people, and it would really make a difference in terms of, you know, helping them to go on to live the life that they would want to lead. And I don't think we would accept sort of doing nothing in other groups. And so I think it's really, really important that we see change in that area.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really nice that you do acknowledge that, you know, you're very privileged to have, okay, a relatively early diagnosis and that support. But that, mm-hmm. I think also, you know, the fact that you are where you are now within your, you know, career and life shows that, you know, with the right support and the right kind of people around you, that you know, you can achieve whatever you want to achieve. And the fact that you are an openly autistic CEO of an autistic charity is a huge achievement.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot of it's been serendipitous and luck, if I'm honest with you, in some ways. But I think it's really fantastic to see. And to have other autistic people on the team as well, I think is something we're really proud of. You know, I think the key thing is just generally to be, as you know, hopefully an accommodating and inclusive place to work. And like you say, I think it is important to recognize, as an autistic person, you know where you're lucky, you know, and in life as well, because obviously the spectrum is so broad. Everyone is having such a range of different experiences, and there's lots of other things that determine how your life is going to work out. Yeah, so I think that is really important. But you know, it's something, obviously, in terms of being open about being autistic, that I have thought very, very carefully about. And again, when, you know, just reflecting on that point around privilege, you know, sometimes people will ask me, you know, do you think more autistic people should be more open about whether or not they're autistic? And I always say that's kind of not the question, really, is it? It's kind of, the question is always like, can more autistic people feel safe and able to be open about the fact that they're autistic? Because the reality is that unfortunately where we are in terms of society and people's attitudes towards autism is that it does involve an element of risk revealing that you're autistic. And I'm in a very fortunate position where I feel like I am able to be able to talk about it and be and be open about that. But you know, again, I would always, you know, just emphasize, like, not everyone feels like they're able to do that, which is a shame. And I think, and that's not down to the person. It's about making sure the person feels like they're in a position where they feel like they can talk about it. And you know, I guess one of the things, you know, even if I'm being completely honest about it, you know, one of the things that I've since I've become CEO, I've definitely talked about the fact that I'm autistic more. And it wasn't like I didn't not talk about it. It's almost like I'm trying to find the sort of phrases that my sort of approach was kind of almost to not hide it, but also not talk about it, if you see what I mean. So I think people were kind of aware of it, but it wouldn't be something like, you know, that I wouldn't necessarily do what I'm doing right now. So yeah, it's something that I, you know, if I'm honest, like I'd love to say that I had the confidence, you know, from the moment I came into the job Autistica to be really open about it. But I guess I've sort of, you know, eased my way into it, because, you know, I was anxious about how people would make judgments around me at the time. And so I think, yeah, it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, it's interesting that, like you say, you had that anxiety going in, and it is, you know, an autistic charity. But I feel like, I think a lot of people get that with workplaces, and I have as well. Like, it's It's difficult because once you get a diagnosis, it feels private, but then you also want to share it so people understand you. And there's no middle ground as to whether to keep this quite personal thing quite private, or if you share it, people either be understanding or judgmental and not understanding. I definitely get that. It's like you have to weigh up every situation or every person that you potentially tell.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, one of the things that, you know, obviously Autistica, last year we launched some 2030 goals, and they were around making sure that people get the right support, making sure that people, you know, we can help autistic people to get into work, get access to healthcare, you know, support for issues like anxiety, make public spaces more accessible. But one of the ones which I think we're really excited about is looking at how we can change people's attitudes towards autism. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily see this as a research question, but to me it absolutely is, because first of all, we need to understand where people's attitudes to autism are right now, but also we need to know what works in terms of changing people's opinions towards autism. And I think what that is one of the real barriers for people is that, you know, and you know, I think you just alluded to it there, is that we're constantly sort of playing this kind of game of chess where you're kind of like trying to work out who you can tell and who you can't. And I should say that, you know, everyone at Autistica has been absolutely amazing about it and very, very supportive, and I think they kind of understand who, you know, who I am and so on. But you know, obviously the people who know you less well, you're constantly trying to work out, you know, how are they going to judge you for this? What sort of assumptions are they going to make about you? I mean, one of the interesting things that I've seen is that people make both positive and negative assumptions about you because you're autistic. So people quite often assume that I'm like, have an amazing attention to detail because I'm autistic, and like, then they read my emails and they're quite disappointed because like it's going to be 5 different grammar errors in them or something like that. And so yeah, it is really fascinating to see that. And you know, obviously in the work that we're doing, we can see that in society, you know, people still sort of very much see autism as something that's just a learning disability. You know, and we see about a third of people that think that. We see that, you know, a lot, you know, almost 2/5 of people think that autistic people lack empathy. You know, people think, you know, that everyone exists on the autism spectrum in some way. And, you know, there's a lot of myths that are still prevalent around autism, which we need to work to try and change.
Mm-hmm. I mean, some of those, I don't know, just assumptions are really, it's really kind of baffling to hear those, that people genuinely think that we lack empathy. Mm. And I think people just base off what little they know, or little, you know, they've come into contact with autism. I think just not many people realize that actually during their everyday life they're probably interacting with a lot of autistic people and don't know it. And I think, I don't know, it's just these myths are so like damaging.
yeah. And I think that, you know, I hope, you know, I think sort of the discussions that are being had around neurodiversity, I think might be really helpful in terms of helping people to get their heads around this. You know, that's the interesting thing to me is that, you know, for us, we're really passionate about it, but what are the things that the public needs to know to help them to understand this? Because we can't expect the public to be, you know, the general public to be an expert in this. You know, is this just a case of helping people to understand that everyone in society sees the world differently, and that includes autistic people, and you know, don't make assumptions about that, you know, get understand the person and just try and be flexible, you know, because I do think that the public obviously genuinely want to understand this and want to understand how we can do that. And I think what we're hoping to do is that, you know, is to develop something, you know, or develop an index that will help us to measure that and to help us to understand how things are, you know, how attitudes to autism are changing, and hopefully to understand what can work in terms of changing people's and challenging people's misconceptions. But I think as well, you know, I think the public are you know, obviously trying to, I sort of always have, I'm a bit of an optimist. I always sort of do believe, genuinely believe that people are trying to understand this, but it's just hard. You know, you know, if you, I guess if you're a non-expert, it's just a case of thinking about what we can do to try and try and support the public to understand more about this.
And I definitely think like understanding has come a long way, like, you know, during my life, and I'm sure like your life as well. But like you say, you just, you come across, you know, like the people that see the positives and the negatives, and it's just about trying to like educate all the time. And I think that's definitely something that Autistica is trying to do. And I'll make sure to link to the like 2030. Is it like a, is it like a strategy?
Yeah, but what we're doing, so I guess one of the things that we've really thought a lot about is, like you say, we've got a vision of sort of longer, healthier, happier lives. And then we've tried, you know, we've got our community priority setting exercises and our various research activities. We sort of felt like we needed something that was in the middle, that really tried to explain what our goals were as a charity, what we are trying to achieve through our research. And so we've set these six goals, which we're calling 2030 goals. And, you know, they're the change that we would like to see in society over the next decade. Well, I guess what we're saying as a charity is, you know, this is what we are working towards. We know that we can't do it on our own, but here are the, here are the areas in which we'd like to see change for autistic people. You know, and as I said, it's around sort of making sure people get the right support, access to work, you know, access to proper healthcare, treatments for anxiety, you know, better public spaces and attitudes to autism. And, you know, based on the consultations that we've been doing, the discussions that we've had with autistic people, you know, particularly over the last 5-6 years, these are the things that continually come through to us as priorities. And they're all expressed in different ways. And they're also the areas where we feel there's a real opportunity for Autistica as a charity to make a difference as well. And so that's why we've decided to focus on those areas.
I'll definitely make sure to link to that. And just kind of going back to you, how did you get to be here? So how was it kind of after your own diagnosis? Did you kind of, I don't know, have a sort of passion for autism? I know a lot of autistic people are really like into like researching autism and finding out as much as they can about it. Like, what led you to kind of go into the sort of research avenue and kind of lead you to study it at university? And I think you also have a PhD as well, am I
So I you know, to be honest with you, like, my, you know, initially when I was autistic, when I found out I was autistic, I saw it as pretty bad news. I was really worried about it and really kind of concerned, and obviously my attitudes have changed quite a lot, but the sort of that was the sort of impression I was given initially. So it took me quite a while to get my head around it and to understand it. And the same is true for my parents. And I required, I was at, not at the right school initially, required a lot of support. You know, I ended up in sort of, you know, requiring quite a lot of mental health support as well, you know, including sort of ending up in a mental health unit for a short period of time. But then gradually, when I got that right support at school, I began to, I became a lot more optimistic about the future. I mean, and it was quite an interesting experience and journey, because it changed quite quickly, both in terms of my expectations and my family's expectations and everyone around me's expectations, because I don't think when I went to the school, honestly, where I got the good support, that people really necessarily thought, oh, I was going to get qualifications at school or anything like that. People were just sort of thinking, how do we make sure this person's, you know, health and well-being is secured first and foremost. But things began to change very, very quickly for me, which was great. I began to think, you know, about what I was going to do next. And, you know, lots of people, I was very good at maths and physics, and people were sort of saying, you know, I work in, I'm from Aberdeen, and everyone works in Ireland, Aberdeen. So lots of people were saying, you know, you could be like an engineer or something like that. And, you know, I was interested in that, but you know, also lots of, you know, also I became really, really interested in like, well, why is it that people are autistic, and why, what is it that's different about autistic people? And I guess one of the things I always assumed when I was sort of 15, 16, is that like, I don't understand this, but somebody does. And what became really apparent to me the more I sort of read into it is actually people are really struggling to understand this and what this means, which is why I did a degree in psychology, was to try and learn more. And I also did some courses at Birmingham University as well. And the more I sort of went through psychology, initially I was thinking about doing something like clinical psychology. And the more I looked into it, the more I sort of felt like, well, we actually just don't know what improves things for autistic people. We don't actually know how we, you know, what the evidence is, and what the evidence-based ways are to improve people's lives, what sort of support works for different types of autistic people, and so on. And I also sort of saw a lot of sort of approaches that were quite homogenous, that sort of assumed that you could take this sort of very crude approach to all autistic people and that would improve things. And I always sort of find that a bit sort of baffling, if I'm honest with you, because I obviously had grown also because of the support that I'd had, grown up alongside other autistic people who were all very different. And so I began to think, you know, actually we really do need research. Research is really, the right research is really, really important. So I went and did a PhD, which was looking at, you know, particularly as it's quite specific. It was looking at how autistic people perceived and understood different actions, and it was helping. It was, you know, the aim of the research project was really trying to understand some of the mechanisms that they might explain why autistic people are different. And then I did a postdoc on sort of a similar type of area. And then towards the end of my postdoc, I got approached by Autistica because they were looking for a new director of research, or director of science as it became. And by that time I'd already also been working and volunteering in a range of different areas. I'd been involved in a sort of range of different projects. I'd worked directly with autistic people in a range of sort of different jobs. I'd been involved in policy work in Scotland, so the Scottish Autism Bill, which led to the first Scottish Autism Strategy. And I guess what I saw overall is there was just a real need to link research to the real world a little bit more. And so, for us to have more of a strategy around what we did with research. And I kind of also became aware that like what I was doing, the research that I was doing, it necessarily wasn't going to sort of immediately change things for autistic people or families. And this role at Autistica felt like a huge opportunity to do that, like, you know, to think about, you know, what are people's priorities, you know, how can a charity play a more strategic role in terms of improving things for people. And so yeah, when the opportunity came along, I was just extremely, extremely excited about it. And you know, when I came down, it was, you know, it was quite a small charity. There was only, I think I was the seventh person, and it was amazing. And you know, actually what I also really discovered is that although I love research and I'm a fan of research, I'm not necessarily the right person to be doing it. And actually I much, much more enjoy the sort of thinking around how research can make a difference. And I think, you know, it's interesting, you know, I was telling you earlier that that sort of assumption around people having good attention to detail. And you know, I guess I always assumed about myself, because I was autistic, that I would, you know, that the research would suit me well. And I guess what I learned through the process of doing research is that, you know, although it was something that I was fine at, I wasn't necessarily amazing at it. And actually what I've found since I've moved to Autistica is that this is something which I enjoy more, and I sort of feel like I might have more strengths in. So then I joined Autistica, and I was director of science for 5 years. We sort of set up a network really focused on trying to understand community priorities, and I think really tried to establish at Autistica what research was for. And to me, you know, one of the key things that research can help to address in autism is the fact that autistic people do experience quite serious inequalities, you know, both in terms of health outcomes, but even things like life expectancy as well, and access to opportunities in society, and which ultimately affects quality of life. And so the sort of long, happy, healthy life thing was really important to me in the work that we've done, you know, to try and really amplify the fact that autistic people do experience inequalities in terms of things like life expectancy, is something that I'm really proud of, that we've been able to focus on as a charity. Because although it's quite sad and obviously not good news at all that autistic people experience these outcomes, it's really important that we're able to emphasize the fact that these outcomes exist in order to try and implement change.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting to hear about your journey, and obviously like all the experience you had and the fact you were approached. I mean, how lovely is that? Mm-hmm. it sounds like such a nice charity to work at, in the terms of that I feel like a lot of organizations, especially to do with autism, they're not always kind of elevating autistic people. Mm-hmm. And you don't always, I don't know, they don't always focus on people who are living day to day and who are struggling, like you say, with, you know, potential health, mental health, inequalities and things like that. And I really feel like Autistica puts it kind of back to the autistic people and really trying to raise just like awareness that, you know, these are real struggles that people are facing every day.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, I think the thing, you know, we're trying our best, you know, I think the thing to say is that obviously, you know, Autistica is a work in progress as well. And, you know, autistic people are rightly frustrated and concerned at the rate of progress. And I think that things do need to improve. And I think we can really improve things an awful lot over the next decade. Mm-hmm. But I think the important thing to acknowledge is that there has been progress, you know, as you talked about. It's important to acknowledge that, because if you don't see that, then it feels like we're going nowhere, doesn't it? And I think that's that's not good as well. So like you say, there has been some progress, but we're all, you know, as a charity, we're always trying to learn ourselves. And you know, we definitely get an awful lot wrong, and you know, and you know, as a research charity, obviously we work in a very contentious area, but you know, what we do is we try our best to listen to people. Obviously there are times when we have like a range of different perspectives that we need to listen to, and that can be that's definitely one of the more challenging things about doing this role. Mm-hmm. But I think it does help that we have, you know, autistic people in the organization. And I think you know, we're really proud of the fact that we do our best to listen to the community and to make sure that everything that we're doing has a, you know, called, I guess, what I always use the term theory of change, which is a very charity sector term, but it's actually like just a sort of fancy way, I guess, of saying is like, mm-hmm. you know, you have like a flow chart in your head that basically explains how you're going to make a difference. And I think that at points research has got a bit confused about that. And I think hopefully what we are trying to do, and we're not perfect at it, but we're hopefully getting better at, is really thinking carefully about how our research makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. It's really nice to hear you say that, like, you know, we're not perfect and we understand that. And, you know, things like, you're not always going to say the right thing, or stuff that you say is going to be taken out of context, or, you know, like you're saying, like autism research, it can be quite a, you know, it's a very broad field and it is surrounded by a lot of like controversy and stuff like that. But it's really important that, you know, you own up to that and you're willing to learn and to understand and to involve autistic people, which it sounds like you are.
I think you have to admit that you don't know everything, and then you have to admit that you're going to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And like autism, you know, in autism, in terms of the progress that we need to see in the world, like we're kind of at the foothills and we're all trying to work out how to, you know, how to move forward and how to make things better for people. And that's a, you know, it's a huge learning curve. And you know, but I think that there is huge momentum behind this, and there's, you know, obviously amazing people who are deeply committed to improving things in the field. And I think, you know, I really, you know, and I really, like I said, I told you, I am an optimist, a relentless optimist. But I do believe, you know, we are moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. What is it like working at Autistica? Is it like quite a diverse place? Obviously, you've said that there's other autistic people working there, but are you proud to be autistic working in an autistic charity? And it'd be interesting to hear, because I've kind of read up that you're quite involved across all aspects of the organisation. So, you know, how are you juggling things with like your work day and stuff like that?
So I guess, you know, there's you know, if you as the chief executive of Autistica, I think the first thing is trying to, you know, trying to make sure we get the culture right and improve things as well, and, you know, and make this a welcoming place for everyone to work, so that it, as well, and, you know, one of the things that we sort of talk about in terms of our values is that we specifically value neurodiversity. And you know, one of the things that you know, because we work as a charity, not everyone who joins Autistica actually has a background in autism. They might come from, they might be like a fundraiser, for example, to help us to raise the money to do the work that we're doing. And you know, they don't necessarily understand autism. And when we talk about neurodiversity, sometimes people think that you mean autism. Mm-hmm. And you know, the key thing that we say in terms of our culture at Autistica is that we specifically value neurodiversity, which means we value everyone. And one of the key things that we try to do is to say this is not about creating like an autism, you know, not just like creating like an autism friendly place to work. This is about creating a place to work that works for you regardless of who you are. And trying to understand what that means, and that means a lot of really what that means is just asking people, and specifically, you know, making sure that, you know, we all as line managers are asking people what is it that will help you to succeed. Mm-hmm. And you know, where are the areas that you require some support, you know, what are your strengths and so on. And it's all building a collective understanding of that, and building a collective understanding that we all need to be flexible. And there will be times where it will be challenging. There will be times where there is a tension between someone's needs and what we need to do as an organisation, and we need to accommodate that and to understand that and to make it work. And sometimes there'll be conflicting needs as well. And so I think that's the real key thing, is to have an open conversation around that and build, hopefully, you know, and again, we are, you know, it's interesting, we often hear from other organizations who are looking for us to sort of talk to them about autism and or neurodiversity more generally. And you know, the thing that we always say is, look, we are still, you know, we are building evidence and understanding around this and things like reasonable adjustments and so on. Mm-hmm. But we are still learning how to get this right, and everyone's learning how to get this right, and we will never, we'll never know like how to be perfect. Like, it's always going to be a constant cycle of learning. And then in terms of my daily job, you know, I'm really focused on the work that we're doing with the goals, trying to make sure that we have good plans in place, supporting our head of research, people working on our policy as well. And so the goals are really important. A lot of what I do is building relationships with people, so making sure that, you know, we are working with the government in a constructive way to help them to understand what the issues are. So that could mean meeting ministers, it could mean meeting people within government. Obviously, you know, we need to raise the money, so some, you know, so I spend a lot of time helping for the work to generate income. So that could be meeting our supporters and so on. And then obviously making sure that the team and everyone feels supportive. And so I really divide my time in that way. And so that could be a lot of internal meetings, you know, working with them, going out, meeting people face to face, so on, making, and so a lot of it is about, you know, making sure that we're building right relationships and so on. But yeah, now obviously for us, we're moving back into an office, and so we're sharing an office with the mental health charity MQ at the moment, which has been really, really cool. And getting that right as well for all of our staff has been a really interesting challenge as well. And you know, the way that it works is on for one day a week we are all in the office, and then for and we have sort of priority access to office, and then for another day of the week MQ have it, and then the other 3 days we share the office. And it's been really interesting working out how we make that work for everyone in the team. But so far it's gone really well, and it's been good to move to a more sort of hybrid way of working. And it's been a really interesting challenge, you know, because I think obviously there's a lot of people who really, really value remote working, and some people value in-person working, and some people value hybrid working. And I guess it's exactly what I was just sort of referring to earlier, sort of making sure that we have the necessary flexibility to help us succeed as an organization.
I mean, from everything you said there, it's really interesting to hear obviously about your day, but how you kind of work more generally as a charity. And it's so great to hear that, as like, you know, line managers and stuff, just having that conversation with, like, you know, the people that you're managing, and just being like, is this working for you? I think that's all a lot of autistic people want in the workplace. It's something that I want, is just to have an open conversation and be like, this is what I'm really struggling with, or you know, this is what I'm really good at, could I work on this more, and things like that. So, you know, just having like accommodations in place, but also really discussing with your manager like what you love to do as well, I think is really important. And it sounds like you're working towards having that kind of, you know, happy medium of just actually listening to people and how they work best. And I feel like the pandemic might have opened up that conversation even more, in terms of, like you said, like hybrid working and stuff. I feel like people kind of really know now what works best for them, in terms of, you know, how many days a week they're in the office, or if they work better remotely and things like that. And I think I definitely have as well, like I definitely work better remotely, but you know, I understand the importance of like popping in just to kind of have one-to-one meetings and things like that. And it sounds like you've kind of, you know, having sharing an office and stuff like that, it sounds like you're learning from each other, which is nice.
Yeah. And being alongside another charity, you know, particularly a mental health charity, is really, really helpful. It's a real opportunity for us all to learn from each other. And like you say, it's about what works for every person. And, you know, we don't have any specific, we try not to have too many specific rules. Our main day is everyone is Wednesday. And that's the sort of day we suggest to people that, you know, that they come in and they get to know each other in person, if that's right for them. But I think you know, we try to make it as flexible as possible. And the key thing is like you say, it's just understanding it, each person and their circumstances. And there's such a broad range of circumstances that people have. You know, we've got parents, autistica, people who have different responsibilities, might have different health needs and so on. And I think, you know, everyone really wants to understand what are the rules are. And like my view is, like, you know, actually I don't think it's very helpful to become overly rule based about this. There are some people's rules that mean that, you know, there is less flexibility. They might need to have in person meetings and so on. And there are some people who have, you know, a range of different circumstances, and it's about, you know, flexing according to the person in the role, and not becoming too fixated on how many days people are in the office for example, because I don't think that conversation is particularly, it's interesting, I see it play out in the media quite a lot, I don't think it's particularly relevant to to people and,
Yeah.
and their well-being, but also your organization's success. I don't think people are asking the right question when they start having conversations like that.
No, I think you're right. I think especially when, I don't know, when stuff opened back up again, I think a lot of offices just wanted to see what I say as like bums on seats, because if you're not in the office, you're not working, kind of thing. And I had a bit of that where I'm working, where they kind of want you to be in more because they can see you working, whereas actually so many people work so much better from their own environments where it's that much quieter and things like that. Obviously, I think the hybrid model works really well because it is like the best of both worlds, basically. And it's interesting you saying that, because I definitely agree. I think they're the wrong questions that are being asked of people, you know.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, you know, I guess one question, and like I think it's easy to fall into that thinking. I guess one question I always ask myself, and I think everyone should ask themselves, is if you feel like you need to see bums on seat and you need to see that people are working, like, what does that say? One, about the trust that you have in that person,
literally,
and two, what does it say about your ability to sort of manage and track how people are performing in the role? Because if that's like your only measure, then actually, and I think it probably does flag up things in terms of uncomfortable truths, in terms of, you know, how we all do things. Like, are we all sort of measuring things and measuring how people are getting on in their jobs in an effective way? But like, if your measure is like, I see them at a desk tapping away at a keyboard, therefore they must be working hard or must be being effective, you know, I would question whether or not you're taking the right approach.
Definitely, I agree. And it sounds like the role that you're in now, obviously as the chief exec, it sounds like a very visible role and it sounds like a very social role. How do you find that as an autistic person? Obviously, every person who is autistic is very different, but do you struggle socially? Are you someone that kind of does get burnt out from a lot of, like, you know, kind of social and communication kind of day to day? Like, how do you manage, like, yourself and your mental health?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. So I've definitely spoken to a lot of autistic people, including, you know, lots of very, very successful autistic people who basically, the idea of doing the job that I'm doing is just like the last thing they want to do. I guess it's like a bit of a mixed bag. I really love actually building relationships with people, getting to know people. I love getting to know people and understanding people and having conversations with people. And I really love that aspect of the job. You know, I am one of those people that, you know, actually I quite enjoy being back in. I get quite a lot of energy from being back in the office a couple of days a week, having conversations with people and getting to know people and so on in that way. So that I definitely do get energy from it. But there are also times where it can be a little tiring and you know, it's one of these things where you sort of, you know, you sort of occasionally notice, oh yeah, okay, so this is, you sort of feel like that there are particular challenges there. And obviously, you know, it can be quite tiring, you know, sort of thinking everything through, because you are autistic. And I guess it, at times it could potentially feel like it's a little bit more work than it is for other people to sort of participate in these conversations. But generally speaking, as tiring as at times I can find it, I do really love it. And I am, you know, I guess, you know, one of the reasons why I did the degree in psychology in the end is because I am really interested in people and why people are different, and you know, like trying to understand that and trying to think about how we can all work together to do something hopefully positive. So yeah, I do enjoy the relationship side of the role. But yeah, it's it has its up, I guess, like everything, it has its ups and downs.
It sounds like I've spoken to people before who've really found their like niche when it comes to like a job that they love and they're passionate about, and sometimes it doesn't almost feel like work. Do you think is it kind of bordering on that for you, that, you know, you're just, it's something that does really interest you, that it doesn't almost feel like a day job?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like again, I've used the word privilege a lot. Again, this feels like an incredible privilege to be doing this job. I mean, obviously there are, days where everything goes amazing, that you just think, wow, what an amazing privilege to do this job. And there are days where it feels hard, and you sort of, you're trying to work out if we're getting everything right and so on. And that feels difficult, and it does feel like a job. And I guess, and there's obviously a lot of the day to day that is, of course, everything feels like work in the end in some ways. But I feel unbelievably lucky to be able to do this job. It's a huge privilege, and you never know what the future is going to hold, and so on. But regardless of how, like, my life turns out, I'll always feel privileged to have been able to do this, to do this job, and to have had the experiences that I've had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's really lovely. It was really lovely to hear that, you know, you are so grateful for it, but you can also really hear, like, throughout this, you know, it's almost been an hour, and I've just can really hear the passion and the, like, genuine enthusiasm you have for what you're doing. And I think that's kind of really important. At the end of the day, it should be one of the leading things about, you know, being in a job or career, is that you have that kind of passion or enthusiasm, and that you really do want to see the change. And the fact that you have that lived experience as well, I think, is really important.
Yeah. I think it really helps. Like, obviously, you know, I guess it can be hard sometimes when you're, I think the times when the lived experience thing becomes difficult is it's more personal, and you've sometimes got to be able to sort of park things a little bit in your head. But yeah, generally speaking, to sort of, you know, to have something that you're passionate about is, you know, something that I feel hugely lucky about, and I know that a lot of people don't have in their working life as well. So I think you've just got to remind yourself as well that you're lucky to be in that position, because I think it's very easy to take it for granted.
That's very true. And so what do you do when you're not working? I always like to ask people what their kind of hobbies are or their interests are, like, outside, like what else are you passionate about outside of work?
What do I do?
I've put you on the spot a bit.
It's a really good question. So yeah, I think it's really important that you have things to do outside of work. And, like, I do work hard in what I do, but I'm not one of these people that sort of likes to brag about working 100 hours a week. I don't think that's a good thing to do for anyone, and it would never be something I'd encourage anyone autistic.
That's nice to hear.
I never see anyone talk about autistic. I think the main thing that takes up most of my time, I've got two kids who are 4 and 8, and they're both brilliant to spend time with. I think what's been amazing is watching, you know, particularly my 8-year-old now, who's a little bit older, she's beginning to get really interested in the things that I'm interested in. The things that I'm interested in are, I used to play when I was younger an awful lot of football. I don't really play anymore, but it's something that I still really love. It's still something I really love. I'm really interested in, so I quite often go to games and so on. And I love running and doing sort of sport as well. So I before the pandemic, I've done a few marathons. My fitness has slightly dropped off, I'm afraid to say, during the pandemic for a range of reasons. But I'm trying to get back into it again. So that's a huge thing for me. And, you know, really, my weekends are sort of spent, like, on Saturday morning, I've sort of started helping out with my daughter's team's football, my oldest daughter's football team coaching. And it's really amazing just sort of watching her get into things. And then on Sunday morning, I take her to them to park run as well. And then we've also got a season ticket with the Arsenal women's team as well. And it's been really amazing to see, take her to that as well. And also, like, just sort of see her begin to understand about and learn about the things that that I really loved growing up, and it's really cool that, you know, that she happens to be into it as well, and my sort of youngest daughter is beginning to get into it as well. So I guess that's the main thing, that main way which I spend my time. I've also got a dog as well, which is great as well. It's very, very good in terms of stress relief and so on as well. And yeah, well, and yeah, and obviously so as a family, that's what we, you know, that's what we like to do. And then I guess my wife and I, we both like cycling as well, so we quite often, you know, when we get a chance, we go for the odd cycling trip as well, which is lots of fun. So yeah, that's kind of how I like to spend my time when I get the chance. It's good. I mean, I think that's like the great thing as well with having kids, is that they they really help to create a division between work and everything else, because you really have to, you can't really be half involved. Like, you have to really sort of, you know, spend your time with them, which is really important.
It's really nice to hear that, like what you said at the start as well, is that you've got this work-life balance, and you're not someone that's like, you know, I'm putting in 90-100 hours, like, you know, I'm a real, like, you know, like, I don't know if you kind of ever see those like YouTube like clickbaity videos of like CEOs who are just like working all the time, and I just think it's not really something that's very sustainable. And I think what it sounds like you have is a really nice work-life balance, where there is a divide between like your week and the weekend. And obviously, like you say, it's nice to be involved with your children. They're your children, and you want to see them grow, and you want to be involved with them. And it sounds like you've got that right split, and you sound like a very active family as well.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. I mean, like, yeah, I often think with those videos, I just, like, I am sort of fairly skeptical. And like, I think like, there's this sort of very toxic narrative that going around, like, what it is to be successful. And there's a book called, like, a Berkman book called 4,000 Weeks, and it's called that because that's how much time an average person lives for. Okay. And it's really like a bit of a counterattack on this, like, if you just become more efficient, you can become more effective. And like, well, it is important to have good time management and so on. It's just important to realize, like, you only have a certain amount of time in the day. Mm-hmm. And the reality is like, you know, I don't work 100 hours a week. I probably don't work more than 60 hours most week at maximum, and probably average about, you know, somewhere between 50 and 60, which is, I admit, a lot, but it's also controlled as well. And I think that's the thing. And it's about balancing. It's about balancing your life in an effective way, and making sure that you're, scheduling things. But I know I feel very very lucky again, and you know, obviously it's amazing to have very lucky to sort of be able to do the things that I can do outside of work as well. But yeah, I think it's really important that we promote a sort of healthier approach to work and life more generally, because I think people who go, oh, you just need to work harder, it's not really particularly strategic. Or, and for most people, some people can work 100 hours a week, I can't, and I don't think it's, for most people, it's a particularly healthy or sustainable approach.
I mean, even 50 to 60, like, that's you know, that's a top end, isn't it, really? That's quite a lot.
Yeah, that's a top end for me, certainly. And like, you know, I guess the way that I see it is that, you know, I do running, and like, you know, I've run like a few marathons, and I, you know, I've also screwed up a few marathons before as well. And generally, it happens by like doing what most people do and basically going out too fast and thinking, oh, I feel amazing, I feel fine. But actually, it will catch up with you in the end if you go out too fast and you go out too hard. And it's the same with work. If you try and like floor yourself, then you're going to end up pretty tired pretty quickly. And you got to sort of pace yourself. And also, I think, you know, you don't want to end up in a situation where you're kidding yourself that you're working as well.
Yeah.
Like as well, I think a lot of people put in time that isn't necessarily as effective as it could be. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. Like, I think for me, I really like to structure my time and really, have like written goals and things I can see that I can tick off. Like, I don't want to just be working for the sake of not like achieving specific things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
I know what you mean. Like, it's tricky, but like for me as an autistic person, I just love having structure and routine. So that works quite well for me in terms of like my working day and stuff like that, is having real like to-do lists. I'm a real list kind of person, so that works well for me.
I think as well that what you've talked about is like you have like a realistic approach to things, and I think that's it's really interesting because like one of the things that's quite common is that it's talked about quite a lot with CEOs, which is that basically like they become CEO and they think that because they've had a successful career and so on and they've never nothing's ever went wrong, that quite a lot of people become CEO and then they sort of burn themselves out and they don't understand, and it's because they realize like they have to come to terms with the fact that they're not infallible, that everyone has limits. And I think like talking about the sorts of approaches that you're referring to there, it's about being realistic, right? And planning things and realizing you can't do everything. And I think a lot of people just sort of have like a, I'll just make it happen. And it's like, well, that's not really going to work in the long term. Like you're going to have to be able to prioritize and structure things and plan your time effectively.
Exactly. And I also want to do things like well. I don't want to just be doing them to get them out the door kind of thing. I want to, be proud of the stuff that I'm making and things like that, especially like as a graphic designer. I don't want to rush things. I want to be able to have the time to do things properly. So yeah, it's an interesting topic.
Definitely, definitely.
So we have been talking for over an hour, and that's gone
Yeah.
very quickly. But I'd love for you to kind of mention where people could find out more about Autistica and where to follow Autistica, and also maybe yourself as well.
Yeah, so we're on Autistica. Obviously, you can find out more about the work that we're doing, our 2030 goals, our website, and the attitudes work that we've just recently talked about. I've just put a blog about that up on our website in the index that we're planning to launch. So Autistica is on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook and Instagram, and I am on Twitter and LinkedIn. So my Twitter is Jam Cusack. So James without the E and the S, and then Cusack, which is spelled Cusack. And you'll find me on LinkedIn as well.
Okay, fab. I'll make sure to put those in the show notes. But yeah, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to speak to me. It's been really interesting.
No problem, it's been really fun talking to you. Thanks for having me.